just before placing the incense in the bowl, I looked out and the rain was coming down. The weeping willow tree was cleaning itself. And I thought, this world could just make you weep. It's so beautiful. It's so truly gorgeous. And then while we were chanting the Gatha verse, I opened my eyes and I saw our friends here. And I thought, that's another window. There are so many windows. Is that gonna stay up? Yeah. There are so many windows. And at least just speaking about myself for a second, the way I live is I try to remember to look through the window, to not just go through my life in a daze, but to stop. To stop to look at the tree, to hear the rain, to see the three poisons, to just keep looking, to stay in touch, in other words, to not get lost in the kind of fantasy realm where it doesn't do me any good anyway. Mm-hmm. And speaking of that, I had wanted to mention to you that usually on this, today is Saturday, is that right? Mm-hmm. Usually on this day in the morning, people's bodies are tired, and like with children, when the body gets tired, the child gets cranky. So the mind can get cranky. And, you know, I don't want to go to the circus. You know? I don't want to do that. You know? So that happens. We should know that about ourselves, that because of the body-mind connection, when the body's tired, the mind retreats to can retreat to a kind of cranky place. And fortunately, we have a practice that focuses on our breathing. So every time we do take an inhale, even though the mind is cranky, that's an inspiration. We're actually breathing in. You know, we can actually inspire ourselves with actual life so that when we breathe out, we can actually show up in the present and be where we are instead of lost in the tired body and the cranky mind. And I think it's good for us to remember that, you know, breathing in is inspiration. You know, it can bring our life to our life. And so I wanted to mention that to you, especially today. So today is April 8th, and so in our tradition, this is the Buddha's birthday. So happy Buddha's birthday to all of you. You can wish each other happy birthday. Say, what do you give a Buddhist for their birthday? Nothing. So before we move on to looking at the second of the three poisons, which is this guy, it's hatred or ill will. Or aversion, which that may not be the best thing to serve at the Buddha's birthday party, but it can be tasty if we know how to look at it and understand it. But I want to bring up something that I mentioned in passing yesterday, which I think is very important, which is that when we're in the grips of one of these toxic poisons, when we're really in its grip, they are so powerful, really convincingly, drivingly, determinedly powerful when they've got us in, or when we have gotten lost to it, that they can isolate us and separate us from ourselves, which is a pretty nifty trick. But they can separate us from our true selves, from our sometimes called big self. And they also seem to separate us from others as well. And this is very important for us to understand, because this feeling of separation, we are not really separated, but we feel we're separated, we think we're separated, we have a kind of belief that we're separated when we're in the grips of greed or hatred or delusion, that it creates an enormous amount of suffering for us and spins out one delusion after another. And so the way this comes about in our own lives is that when we feel that we're sufficiently insufficient in some way, and even if we feel it unconsciously, and this gets expressed through our acting out on one of these poisons, you know, it's a kind of, we start to feel somewhere in the back of our mind we're not good enough, and then all of a sudden greed rises and hatred rises and ill will rises and ignorance and delusion rise. They all start to take advantage of that sort of mistaken belief in the back of our mind. It's because we don't yet have enough experience of and confidence in our wholeness. It's really simple. And we don't have enough experience of our wholeness because we're so used to being trapped by this kind of delusion. And we don't have enough experience of our Buddha nature, of our complete being. And so it's very easy. We need to understand it's easy for us to get trapped. But that doesn't mean that wholeness is not true. Just because we're trapped in a delusion. And it doesn't mean that our Buddha nature doesn't exist. It means that through our practice, hopefully, we get more and more comfortable with being what we really are. And that can help. So, but what happens when we're trapped is that we're at a distance from our big self. And it's interesting. You've heard me say this before, but you know that in the Judeo-Christian tradition, the definition of sin is not evil. It's alienation from the source. It's alienation from oneness. And so we're caught in that. That's what happens. We're in that, and it feels bad. We know it feels bad. And so instead of being, you know, at one with ourselves, we're sort of trapped and we're stuck believing the subconscious gossip and the, you know, the stories that the smaller personality self, as opposed to the bigger self, that likes to convince us are real. So we're like characters in a story that's told by a very biased and an uninformed narrator who objectifies us and tries to convince us that what we are is not what we are. So it tries to convince us in an untruth, basically. And this, of course, strengthens the delusion inside of ourselves because we're so used to hearing that voice. That radio show is always on, and this helps the three poisons to grow. So we need to know that this is real. I mean, this is really a struggle between reality and unreality, or between that which affirms life and that which would take life away from us. It's very important we understand that. And this, as I said, this dis-ease, it's a disease, you know, these poisons are toxic, but this lack of ease with ourself also makes us feel, as I said, different from other people who, from the outside, seem to be getting along just fine. Everybody's doing good but me. That's what it looks like in our mind. So we end up feeling other from ourselves and we end up feeling other from other people, which is not a good place to be. It is a very lonely place to be. It's a very isolated place to be. And any of you who have ever felt really other knows how painful this is. And yet this is something that when the poisons get activated in our lives, we get separated or we feel separated from others. So it's not good news. And sadly, once we get caught by this delusion of otherness, and feeling alone, it's very easy for us to then go and make other people absolutely other. Do you recognize that? Once we're caught being separated from ourselves and separated from reality, all of a sudden it's really easy for us to objectify other people and make them other, which could lead to all kinds of delusions. It makes greed easier, for example. So maybe sometimes people will take too much food or they'll take too much time or too much attention from somebody, even though other people need it. But we say, hey, they're not my problem. They're other. And we actually believe that. And so we act that way. Or maybe we cut in line or we jump the queue or we, you know. And greed, for example, as I said, it will always justify itself. It will always find a way to do it. So, or to bring in the precepts, maybe we don't tell the truth. Or maybe we want to get something, so we find ways to justify our manipulating and flattering and intoxicating people with stories of themselves or something else. And, you know, or maybe we just praise ourselves and at the expense of other people. Because once we're convinced that we're other, then everything else is other. And then you see what the problem is. The problem is that we're just trapped in the delusion. So it sounds like I'm saying that we're, you know, maybe we're not so good. But we are good people. And it's important for us to be very honest about this, to know that good people get caught in delusions. And it happens all the time. And the internal mechanism that strengthens all these kinds of harmful attachments can work its way into the smallest part of our lives, and all of a sudden we end up acting or saying or, you know, thinking things that we know are not quite right, but we're so trapped in the story that we end up doing that. So it's very important, as I said yesterday, for us to be very kind with ourselves, but also very determinedly clear to know this part of our lives. Because it's this part of our lives that, in Buddhist understanding, is the cause of all the suffering and all the attachments and all the aversions that we create. And so just like it's true of greed, it's also true of the second poison, which is hatred or ill will, aggression, aversion. And this poison has many, many, many faces. It can start with just a mild dislike. It can move on from there to a real judgmental disapproval of someone. Really, all of a sudden, we're getting a little hard-hearted about them. We can even feel disgusted when we hear their name. This is all part of the second poison. If we generalize it, this can become prejudice about a whole group, which is dangerous. Prejudice leads to intolerance. All of a sudden, everyone but us is on a short leash. Oh, look what they did. That's just like them. We do that. We all do that. That could lead to animosity. And of course, it could lead to anger. And each thing justifies and builds this escalating ladder of hatred and ill will and aversion and aggression. And then it gets really serious. Then we have outright discrimination that comes from this poison, called racism, homophobia, gender bias. These are all rise from the ground of that second poison. And these things lead to bullying. They lead to being exclusionary. Sometimes they lead to death. This second poison is a very serious business. And in the worst case, it leads to war. So we need to know that poison is so toxic that it can infiltrate the smallest part of our life and all the way to barrel bombing children in Syria. And that's the second poison functioning in the world. It's a pretty sad litany, but this is what happens when we are not discriminating in our awareness and understanding of this lie of insufficiency in ourselves, of this untruth that we are separate from other beings. You know, I mean, it's basic in Buddhism that we are not separate. And when otherness gets a hold of us and starts to run unexamined and free in people's hearts and minds, this is what happens. And I don't think we can turn away from it. We need to know it. And if we look really deeply at these feelings and these views and these opinions that can infiltrate our minds, you know, we're right and they're wrong, we're good and they're bad, you know, this kind of dualistic craziness that causes so much pain, we find that, like greed, there are many causations that have gone into creating this inside of ourselves, creating the ability for this delusional poison to affect our lives. So, for example, maybe we have our own personal reasons for being that way, but then what about the historic and cultural institutionalization and influence of racism? No one escapes their culture. We, here in Canada, in the United States, everywhere else, we all have grown up in a racist culture. And we cannot pretend that we haven't. We have all grown up in primarily homophobic culture. And we have all grown up in a gender-biased culture. And that all gets woven into our psyches and can be very, very confusing. And it is very hard for individuals to break away from the prevailing wind of a culture. Just the fact that you good people, as my teacher used to love to say, and I love the phrase, you good people, just the fact that you good people come and sit sesshin and practice at home and try to touch the true self and try to be with the truth is an absolute revolution. It's a completely radical thing to do, given the enormous forces that feed the poisons in our lives and in our cultures. So, fortunately, to help counteract the effect of these poisons, we have practices that help us to understand and also to transform these toxic branching streams that hide in the darkness so that we don't stay attached to them. And we have a way to deal with them. Now, I included anger in that list, and I want to talk about this a little bit because I think it's important for us to make a distinction between the kind of upset or anger that is rooted in delusion and separation and the kind of anger that is rooted in connection. These are not the same thing. When Dr. Martin Luther King, who if you've heard me talk before, you know who I admire greatly, when he felt a very real anger at the forces that kept African Americans down, he was so completely connected with himself and with the people that he could feel, and he never lost connection, he never lost contact with the source of his anger, which was love. And just listen to it for a minute. There is anger that rises not from the ground of delusion, but that gets instigated by love. And the anger was just a symptom of the love that he felt for the people and for justice and for equality and for freedom and for decency, all of which were being denied to him and to his people. And he was so connected and so deeply loving of those people and the things that I just mentioned to you that a natural impulse of anger rose up inside of him. But he knew that to act on that symptom, the anger, in its raw form, would just make things worse. And so Dr. King had a profound faith, and he depended upon his spiritual practice, and he depended upon his faith, and he depended upon his wise commitment and his determination to model peaceful protest and nonviolent opposition and expression, because that's what the love really wanted, a way to help this poison stop affecting his life and the lives of others that he stayed close to. So he stayed connected to and he acted from the deeper source, not from the physiological impulse to strike out. So he stayed deep inside of himself. And that's why he was able to succeed at what he succeeded at. And any of you who has ever seen or participated in any of those civil rights marches or seen films of those people walking into the dogs and the fire hoses, that was not easy to do. And if it had just been anger motivating him, he wouldn't have been able to do it. There was a deeper source for that action. And of course, the same is true of Nelson Mandela, you know, who was able, out of love, to live in that cage for 37 years without hatred. Just imagine that. Imagine someone locking you up because of the color of your skin and living in a cage for that long and coming out loving. So he didn't lose that source. And the women who worked for women's right to vote in the last century, and the women working and men working for equality between genders now, it's not some feeling of insufficiency in themselves or a belief in the delusion of separation that caused them to do the things that they do and the things that they did to bring about social change. It was a profound connection that they felt. And the ability to see through the anger and to keep their eyes on the prize, to not lose the source. And that's why they didn't act out of anger. They took very brave and very wise and very vulnerable steps in order to bring about the desired result. And I believe, and I also hope, that the people working actively for climate action now will not lose the source and start creating enemies and others of those who oppose them and those who really don't care about harming the earth. We still can't make them other. That is dangerous. That's the poison functioning. And Dr. King spoke more than once about the pain that he felt and said that no matter how deeply the pain he felt personally ran at the injustice and even the killing that his people had to endure, that he would not be enticed to become the same as those who were doing those things and hated them. Some people think that King was a great political strategist, but I disagree. I think it was wisdom. I don't think it had... Of course, it was a good political strategy because, you know, the other guys had bigger guns. As we saw, he was killed. But I think it's wisdom, and it's wisdom that kept Dr. King and the other people that I mentioned and many others from succumbing to the delusion of separation. They knew that their anger and their upset was rightful because they stayed connected, because they knew they weren't separate, because they knew, even though everyone was telling them you're other, that they were not other. They had that foundation, and in Zen, that foundation is called reality. This is Dogen's teaching on non-separation in action in the modern world. Dogen is right in the middle of this. I've said many, many times, if we only really understood what Dogen meant by non-separation, we would not have these problems because we could not function based on the poisons of delusion. We would function based on the truth of the reality of non-separation. Now, Dogen is right in the middle of this, and it's very important, I feel, that we acknowledge that. So because their foundation was the reality of non-separation, they were able to work constructively, and they didn't make those who opposed them other. They didn't make them enemies. They just kept walking the path they knew that was on real ground, and that is so important. And that path was the path of a unifying a loving kindness and love. They actually, and we saw that at the Dakota Pipeline too. Those wonderful people who put themselves on the line in the middle of blizzards. Anger won't get you through that. Reality will. You know, most of us are not, we're not Gandhi or Martin Luther King.
And anger wouldn't have brought the thousands of deaths.
No, that's right.
To come and support.
That's right. Yeah, when the American veterans went to support the First Nations people, I wept.
Yeah.
I thought, wow, they know. They really got it. The very forces that destroyed those people have come to be with them. You know, the U.S. Armed Forces that destroyed First Nations people came to say, we're here with you. That was amazing.
Yeah.
That was just mind-blowing. Vision does that. Realization of reality and non-separation does that. Not the other, not delusion. So in our ordinary lives, I think we need to be honest and, you know, look at ourselves clearly and know that we have all felt some kind of maybe hatred, but also a kind of low-lying, persistent ill will about someone or something or some situation. And it tends to dig a very deep groove. It's very skillful. It digs a very deep groove, like a record groove, that plays the same old song. And it sounds something like that. He's bad, he's bad, I'm good, I'm good. They're no good, I'm real great, I'm real great. You know, boo, boo, yay, yay. That's the song. I mean, has any of you heard that song? Or am I the only one who tunes into, like, K-Hate?
It's a movie, too.
Yeah, it's a good movie. It's a good movie, you know. But, you know, these, again, just like Reed, you know, hatred and ill will and aggression and aversion, these are also just energies. We need to know that. They're actually not solid states. These are energies that can be transformed. And there's a lot of energy in the heat that comes. There's a lot of calories, you know, in the heat that comes with hatred. And all the more subtle forms of aggression. As you remember what I told you, what Suzuki Roshi said when talking about delusion and enlightenment, he said, a big block of ice makes a lot of water. Big block of ice. Good delusion? Good. Big enlightenment. Because it can be transformed. And so, you know, this is where knowing how to work with these poisons is so important to those of us who want to sort of calmly go forward and live our vows to help this world and to help free all beings. One of the things that I think we really need to know this, we have an aversion to knowing about our aversion. You know, we don't really want to know it so well. I think we need to draw it closer to us. And one of the things that we really need to understand about it is that it's very sticky. Its ill will is very convincing. I mean, you get a seed of it, and you can feel the light going out in your heart. But then it justifies itself. It tells us a story. It's really in love with itself. And it seduces us. Because one of the first things that happen when we feel ill will or hatred or aversion or aggression, anybody want to say, what do you feel like when you're feeling that? We feel powerful. It makes us feel a kind of power. It makes us feel a kind of almost superior. That's why it's so easy to make other people other. We're better. We're not them. And so it's very seductive. And it can be really, really hard to unhook ourselves from this poison. But the good news is that with determined practice, you know, just bearing witness and seeing these feelings and belief for what they are, not judging ourselves because they're just part of human life that we have to try to help ourselves with, we can help loosen their grip on us. And as time goes by, and we do work with them consciously, we choose to work with them, with these poisons, or in this case with the second poison of hatred or aggression or ill will, it makes it harder for it to hang on to us very long. It may still grab us, but we can shine a light on it pretty quickly, pretty quickly. And once we do, we can make a great change, and it's important that we're able to do it. One of the ways that, you know, those of you who have been here before, I've told you, one of the ways is, like, for example, if I'm having some feeling like that, I go to my cushion. And I go there, I go there not to think about it or get to the bottom of it. I go there just to sit zazen. And then because I'm sitting, my ill will is, or my aggression is sitting. So it's getting to do zazen with me. Because it's not like it's in a different mind.
So, and the more I sincerely do that practice, the more it gets the benefit of that practice. And then sometimes, when I'm done, I'll stand up and all of a sudden I understand something. And I didn't try to think it through. I couldn't think it through. I just suddenly, I'm facing this way. I'm angry at someone, or I'm aggressive, or whatever it is. And then all of a sudden, I'm facing that way. And all I did was sit down and get up with a choice to practice in between. And another approach is like the practice where we offered generosity and contentment as the antidote to greed. So hatred and ill will and aversion and aggression, they also have an antidote. Do you want to say what it is?
Kindness.
Loving kindness. It's metta. Yeah. It's right there in our practice. In Buddhist belief, Buddhist understanding, the word metta, which is the Pali word, and maitri is the Sanskrit word. I'm a little scholarly, so I like to make sure you know these things. But metta, or loving kindness, is considered a divine abode. Isn't that amazing? Think of that. A divine abode. A divine place to live and dwell. And metta is the first of what are called the four immeasurables. The four immeasurables are loving kindness, metta, compassion, joyous appreciation of others, and equanimity. And so metta, or loving kindness, is the very first one. And they're called immeasurables because there's no end to them. There's nothing. Once loving kindness starts flowing into the world, there's no internal stopping place. And the same with compassion, the same with joyous appreciation of others, and the same with equanimity. There's nothing to stop it. There is no block. The only thing that could stop it is if we stop doing it. There's no force that can stop that other than ourselves. And so metta works because it's really great, loving kindness is great medicine for ill will, because it instantly removes our clinging to this negative state that tends to control us otherwise. And I've been doing a lot of metta practice lately, every day now, for quite some time. And all I can say is it really helps. It's really good. I can go from being in this kind of not a really good place to being, to letting my true being express itself right inside of me. And it's just, again, it's just like flicking the switch. We should know. We can flick the switch, but the thing is that we have to keep doing it. We have to keep practicing it so it gets stronger. I should tell you that sometimes during metta or loving kindness practice, we can be surprised, because sometimes grief or sadness or anger will rise right in the moment that we're opening ourselves to loving kindness. And that's not a bad sign, actually. That's good news, because it means that the part in us that has had our heart constricted is starting to soften and open up, and these little things are going to come out, but they'll move through. One of the nice things about metta practice is that if you're doing metta practice and you start feeling sad or angry, you can do some metta practice for that feeling. You can send loving kindness to the feeling itself, because it needs it, right? So I want to offer a metta practice to you now, which some of you may have done in some form. And as I said yesterday, if you feel comfortable doing this now, then you're welcome to. Please participate and join in. And if you prefer not to, you can just sit here in the divine abode of of loving kindness that we're creating here in Stoll Lake Farm, and enjoy your breathing. And this is a I'm going to teach it to you by guiding it, but then you can do this on your own. This will belong to you. And this is a practice where we say certain phrases, four phrases. And it's best if we don't say the phrases in some kind of automatic, just saying the words. Approach to it. It's best if, as we say the words, we sincerely, we find a place to sincerely mean them. And so we actually hear the words as we're saying them. And when the practice is sincere, loving kindness will emerge very, very quickly. And I think you'll see. So let me ask you to just close your eyes and make sure you feel comfortable in your body. Just kind of breathe quietly. And I'm going to say the phrases in a certain way. And then you can say them inside your mind, inside yourself, and just let it sink in as you say it. First, we're going to offer this loving kindness to ourselves because we need it. And also because of our vows to help other beings, we want to be able to give it, and we can't give what we don't have. So it's like an in-breath. We give it to ourselves at first. And so we can say to ourselves, may I be happy, loving, and kind. Because we can be happy, and we can be loving, and we can be kind. So say that until you can actually feel that a little bit. It's like a deepest wish for yourself. May I be happy, loving, and kind. And then may I be well. May I be physically well, healthily, mentally well, emotionally well. May I be well. May I be safe. Safe from any inner or external threat or harm. I want to be safe. And may I be peaceful and at ease. Let's do it again for ourselves. My deepest wish, may I be happy, loving, and kind. Please, may I be. And may I be well. May I be safe. May I be peaceful and at ease. When you're doing this on your own, you can do this for 10, 15 minutes. Settle into it in yourself. And then think of someone you feel close to, someone who's been kind to you. Maybe get a picture of them in your mind. You can smile at them. May you be well. May you be happy. Loving and kind. I want that for you. May you be happy, loving, and kind. And may you be well. You dear thing, may you be safe. Let nothing hurt you. And may you be peaceful. And be at ease in yourself. And you can offer that to them again, just inside yourself. May you be happy. May you be loving and kind, please. May you be well. be safe. And may you be peaceful and at ease. I wish for you. And now we can think of someone who you don't necessarily know. Maybe someone you just noticed in a store. Maybe the teller at the bank. See them in your mind, in your heart. May you be happy, loving and kind. We don't have to hold this back just for people we know. I want you to be happy, loving. May you be well. And may you be safe. I want you to be safe. And may you be peaceful and at ease. And just working with your breath. And now, if you can, think of somebody that maybe you've had some difficulty with. They're not other. They're not apart from you. And so think of them. May you be happy, loving, and kind. And may you be well. And may you be safe. And despite our difficulty, may you be peaceful and at ease. Because it's a Buddha's birthday, let's come back to ourselves one more time. May I be happy, loving, and kind. May I be well. And may I be safe. And may I be peaceful and at ease in my life. And then feel your body right where you are and slowly come back into this divine abode of loving kindness, which is your mind. And you can open your eyes when you're ready. Anybody feel an upsurge of hatred? How did it feel to you? What did you notice in the process? Were you able to start with yourself? Were you able to actually wish yourself happiness? Did you notice? See, there's a little trick in that. Many people just say, may I be happy. But happy is different than loving and kind. But if we're not loving and kind, we're not going to be happy. So I put them together. Because it's a little like, I want to be happy, and I do want to be loving, and I do want to be kind. They kind of go together. So that's why I put them together. How did it feel to hear yourself say to yourself, may I be well? May I be safe? Such basic human needs.
That felt really good for me because I realized that I hadn't really been wishing that for myself. You know, I feel physically unwell.
Yeah. I mean, I have something I'm dealing with, and may I be well?
Yeah.
I really want to be well. I want to be well. I really do. You know? And so the more you say it, you really hear, I really do. I really do. I really do want to be peaceful. I really do want to be kind. It's like good reminders, you know, they're like, it's like crib notes. How did it feel to offer this to someone that you feel close to or someone who's nice to you? How'd that feel?
Easy.
Easy? Huh? Easy. Easier than to the self, right? Yeah. This is a litmus test. It's easier to do it for someone else than for the self because we have made ourselves other. And not in a, like, positive way. Right? That shows us the distance from ourselves. So it's good to know it. And that's why I say, you do metta for yourself a lot. You need it. So that you can give it. How about the bank teller? Did you enjoy that?
Yeah.
I always enjoy that. I always enjoy thinking, oh yeah, I saw that little kid with that dog. Oh, may you be happy. You know, I don't need to know them. This is a general... In a way, this is an expression of our vows in the world. And then how about for anyone who did it for someone with whom they may have had some difficulty? How was that? I can't hear.
Easier than having difficulty.
Easier than having difficulty.
That's the most challenging one.
Say it again.
That's the most challenging.
For someone you've had difficulty with.
Yeah, because I think when you talk about anger on a global level and on
Mm-hmm.
When you talk about it at a personal level, that's a difficulty with that one because sometimes anger helps you set boundaries so that you can feel safe.
Mm-hmm. But what will help you set the boundaries so you can feel safe is recognizing that the reason you're angry is because you value yourself. And so if you set the boundary because of the anger, that's going to be pretty shaky because you're going to have to stay angry to keep that boundary. Whereas if you recognize the source of the anger is that I value my life and I don't want to be treated that way, now you're on solid ground. Mm-hmm. So it's remembering, wait a minute, there's a source here. I want to go to the source because I can't maintain the anger all day and I don't want to be angry all the time just so that somebody doesn't treat me badly. So I'm going to get to where the anger comes from. Now I've got solid ground. I'm not treated that way. Not, I hate your guts. I'm not treated that way. Not by you, not by me, and not by anybody. That's just the way it is. So if you're looking for someone to treat that way, you have to go somewhere else. Because I'm not treated that way. Why? Because you're coming from the source place. It's such a different way to come at it. Yeah, Jeff.
To me, there seems to be such a huge difference between anger and hate.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas anger, I agree, it can be very empowering and you can feel connected and you can feel loved, all these things. Hate, I think, is more the poison. When you're caught in hate, that's when disconnect. I don't believe Gandhi hated. I don't believe that Gandhi's people.
You
Gandhi hated or Martin Luther, I think they were angry.
Yeah.
And that's okay.
Yeah. And hate is a very different thing. If any of you who have, seen the films or, you know, the newsreels or whatever they call them these days, I don't know what they call them, but, you know, of the people going after those young black children trying to go to school, you see the look on their face, you see the hatred. If you looked at some of the footage
of the Trump rallies, where hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of white people are screaming at a black woman, and someone punches her, and Trump says, "Get her the hell out of here." We are in massive delusion land here. And that, if you looked at their faces, you saw the rage of hate. It's very, very different. And it is a true poison. They don't know that woman. You know what her crime was? She had a different opinion. And she was a woman. And her skin was brown. All three. Pardon?
At her political leanings as well.
Yeah, right. She had a different opinion. So we need to stop, but I'm going to... I'm going to suggest that you might choose part of one of our zazens today to practice metta. Do it, well, you know, do it here. Do it while you're sitting. You know, maybe you could take 15 minutes or 20 minutes, whatever it is. Take the whole period if you want. But may I be happy, loving, and kind. May I be well. May I be safe. May I be peaceful and at ease. And then extend it. Yeah, Chris.
I was wondering before they left, just to say one thing about the schedule. Between the launch of the work practice and work practice, is 15 minutes.
Yeah. So to what?
To like make it just 5 minutes between the bancho going and work practice beginning.
Because doesn't the bancho mean change into your clothes for work practice?
Yeah, everybody was pretty
good. Oh, yeah?
Well, okay. We made it 10 minutes.
Well, whatever you want to do, we can do. You decide.
Okay, let's make it 10 minutes so that everybody's at the week sort.
That's okay.
Bancho starts at the same time.
So...
Yeah, and
10 minutes after be at the... Okay. Okay, thank you. So, let's chant our vows.